Welcome back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with the movers, the shakers, the film and TV makers, those producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, editors, production designers, costume designers, VFX gurus, sound mixers, sound editors, authors, composers, you name it. And we talk to them. We've been doing a lot of talking the past few weeks, especially when it comes to Dances with Films, which hot in the middle of that right now in Los Angeles at the TCL Chinese Theater 6 Complex. That's the upstairs 6 Theater venue above the Chinese Theater itself with its hand and footprint courtyard, which, by the way, if you're hitting up Dances with Films, take a gander and head on down to the Chinese Theater courtyard and check out the newest hand and footprints there, Carol Burnett's. I can't believe she did not have hand and footprints there until now. Absolutely amazing. But that now, that situation has been rectified. And she had a beautiful hand and footprint ceremony the other day there. Dick Van Dyke was there. Her castmates from Palm Royale, which she gave an update. In addition to us already knowing that there will be season 2 of Palm Royale. Oh, God, I'm so excited for this. She thinks they're going to start filming in the fall. So everybody be on the lookout for season 2 of Palm Royale in 2025 with more Carol Burnett. But yeah, joining her to salute her was Allison Janney, Laura Dern, Maya Rudolph was there, Mindy Cohn was there, just Julia Duffy, and of course her longtime friend Dick Van Dyke was there. So just that's one of the good pieces of news in Hollywood and entertainment this past week, is Carol Burnett getting her hand and footprints. So if you head up over to Dances with Films, take a gander and go check them out. Because it's somebody of her caliber. You might not see that again in your lifetime with the legend that she is. So, but Dances with Films, we had some great filmmakers on last week, all with films at Dances with Films, The Exposed, Xenia LeBlanc's, that had its world premiere on, what was the 22nd, Pam? Saturday? Friday? Saturday. Okay, Xenia's film, world premiere at in the Midnight Shorts block on Saturday. Coming up on the 25th, which is tomorrow, Nick Acosta's The Pickup and Stimson Sneed's The Brilliant. Tim Travers and the Time Traveler's Paradox. They're both at Dances with Films tomorrow. Today, joining us in just a moment here is going to be writer-director Meredith Yinger with her world premiere at Dances with Films film, the documentary Scars Unseen. And then later in the show today, he's back, not Frank Meyer, Steve Baldwin. Pam's laughing. Frank's still shooting for that number 5, and he wants a fifth appearance jacket or shirt, just like they do on SNL. Steve Balderson is back for the fourth time, this time to talk about his streaming series. This is something new. Steve has not done that before. He's been on the show talking about books and films, his films before, but not a series. This is a brand new venture for him. It's bloody famous. It's on Prime Video. It is to die for. Dark, twisted, delicious, wicked comedy. Sarcasm. I love it. And satire. So, Steve will be joining us later. But first, let's welcome Meredith Yinger to the show. Hi, Meredith.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to talk with you.
I'm excited to speak with you. I mean, here you are. You've got the world premiere of Scars Unseen happening June 30th, next weekend, in the afternoon. How exciting is it for not only the world premiere, but to have the world premiere of Scars Unseen? And this, I believe, is your first feature, Doc.
This is.
Okay. And have it at Dances with Films.
And Dances with Films, and in my hometown, because I'm from L.A., so this is huge for me.
It's a trifecta.
It is, yes. I can't believe it. I'm so excited. Dances with Films is really awesome, and I can't wait for people in the community and, you know, my friends and family to come and see it and in Chinese theaters, which is the dream, you know, the dream venue.
You know, I mean, and, you know, it's going to be upstairs in the Theater 6 complex, which it's a nice little complex. They do have their snack stand is great. Their bar upstairs is really great. So for people that are milling about waiting to see your film.
There's lots to do around there.
There's a lot. And, of course, as I said at the top of the show, people can also go down into the courtyard, the Chinese Theater courtyard, and they can now see Carol Burnett's Hand and Footprints.
Which
were just immortalized the other day. So
yes, I love that. That's very exciting.
And she's a local girl too. Come on, she went to Hollywood High School. Grew up a couple blocks.
We've got so much in common.
See, you're in good, and you both have a presence at the Chinese Theater. Look at that.
Yes. I'm honored to be among the stars.
Well, you know, I think a lot of them would be honored to have you among them with your documentary, Scars Unseen. A powerful and important documentary, Meredith. Tell everybody, how would you describe this documentary?
So Scars Unseen really is like the most wonderful project that I'm so excited to share with. But Scars Unseen really is not about the putting the emphasis on the act of abuse. It's really focusing on the resilience of these women and the triumphant moments and the process of healing and how we as a society can all be more trauma-informed. And that's what I really, really want people to know, because they hear, you know, oh, it's a documentary about domestic violence, but it's like, it's really a documentary about these women overcoming time and time again these situations and how they have found healing and how, you know, what that looks like and how it'll look different for everyone, but that there is a way, and really just to provide a glimpse of that and some hope.
Well, it really, the sense that I got with the three women that you focus on, Maha, Adrienne, and Trish, each very different backgrounds, very different situations, and each focusing on not only surviving, but thriving.
Yes.
And that those two words are what really stand out for me and kept bouncing in my mind as I'm watching and hearing each of these women. This is all about surviving and thriving. And that's something we don't usually see, as you very succinctly pointed out. Most of documentaries about domestic violence, they focus on the violence itself.
Yes.
And not the aftermath. And how we all see unfold on the news. We see it, hear about it on social media, the tragic aspect of it. And what happens when women don't get out or when they don't say something. But you give us a positive spin here, something positive that actually anybody can subscribe to the mindset of these women to turn their lives around. And we see that Maha, I mean, her domestic abuse, domestic violence, that is new level. That hearing her talk, new level, essentially being a prisoner, you know, in another country, and you've got armed guards around her with guns. That is new level. That's so for her to have escaped, come to the United States, And now she, to see her talk about working through her issues and finding peace and relief and growth with yoga. And now she is a yoga teacher and teaches meditation and yoga to others, men and women alike, to get mm-hmm. centered and find their balance. That's a life lesson that almost anybody can benefit from.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. I think there's a universal takeaway, just in exactly like you're saying, your situation might not look like this, but we can all take these, you know, tales of trial and error and triumph and empower ourselves to change whatever that narrative is and to find a new way forward and to figure out what works for you, right? Because it'll be different. It'll be different for everyone.
Yeah.
But to really look to these women, I'm constantly inspired by them. And truly, we don't hear enough of these stories.
No.
You know, like you're saying, we focus and glamorize the abuser and the act of abuse. And it's never the focus on, okay, how did these incredibly strong women predominantly get out of those situations? What does their life look like now? Because if you don't see it, how can you possibly imagine doing that for yourself or implementing that in your own life?
Yeah. And of course, I think the greatest example of a woman who and her resilience is Trish, the founder of Safe Passage. And what's it been now, 23, 25 years that since she founded Safe Passage?
Yes, she's been doing this work for decades.
Yes, and it's truly, and I love the detail that you capture, and you hear her talk about these women can come to her, and they get home makeovers on the outside, and she's really doing a pay it forward because of a kindness that a doctor paid her, a doctor and a nurse in a small, you know, hospital setup, more or less a rural mm-hmm. hospital setup, the kindness that they showed her when she got out of the situation she was in. And she has now more than paid that forward. And she provides makeovers and medical, you know, cosmetic surgery to repair injuries and damages, dental help, clothing, outfits, so these women can go out and get jobs. Trauma care for mm-hmm. to help their mental outlook and to deal internally with what's happened to them. She is just, her work has been absolute amazing. And I've heard of Safe Passage before over the years.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Just outstanding. So I love how you have, because she's like, she can be a one-stop shop and send people everywhere that they need to go. Seriously. And one,
she is, though. She knows, she's got all of the connections, and she really approaches it from the whole person, you know. So there are tons of resources available, and, you know, I did want to amplify their work that they're doing, and they're local, and, you know, they're expanding, too, in terms of where their offices are located. So their work is truly amazing and helps a lot of people.
It really, really does. Now, I'm curious, what led you to this story? What was the impetus, the genesis of Scars Unseen?
Yeah. You know, it kind of goes back a few years. I think the seed was planted when I was filming another short documentary that was called Story in Her Eyes. And it was about these friends and people that I had met while I was living in Austin, Texas, and I realized that they almost all had an underlying current of abuse. And that wasn't even the initial point of the interview, but the takeaway was how common this was, and I was really taken aback and outraged, you know, on their behalf. So I think initially that kind of planted the seed, and then through my production company, SheTV Media, we met Trish at a networking event, and we started working with her nonprofit, Safe Passage, and creating content. And after just hearing Trish's you know, story. It just, I feel like this project has constantly been the snowball effect, right? Like we get one person on board and then it just kind of grows into its own living entity. And through Trish, we were filming an event and that's where we met Maha. and then Adrian actually found us through our crowdfunding campaign. And I just feel like synergistically, it's kind of just attracted the right people that were meant to be part of this film. And I've had family and friends who have experienced domestic violence and even more have come forward in the process of me making this film, which has been, you know, heartbreaking and also eye-opening, but really just my motivating factor to continue to push this documentary forward and to get it out there. For them and for everyone who hasn't come forward, you know, I really want this to be a beacon of hope and to let people know that they're not alone.
So in other words, it all started with Trish again. It all starts with Trish. So
everything goes back to Trish. She opened the door for everything.
This just reinforces what we had just finished saying, that
yes,
all of her contacts and everything that she's done for these 25 some years, she is the one. She is the person. She and Safe Passage. Now, once you decided you wanted to make a documentary about this, did you always intend to have the survive and thrive and resilience aspect to it? How did it come about as to the direction, the through line you wanted this to take versus talking about the violence itself more than the recovery and the thriving?
Yeah, I think going into this, I did always want it to not be like what has already been created previously. And to me, the best takeaways, the best films, my favorite, are the ones that make you feel something, whether that be empowered, you know, outraged, something. And I felt like I wanted this project, especially because of my relationship with these women, to be that of empowerment and that of showcasing their triumph. And we did approach it with that undertone as to what helped them get to where they are now, right? Because where I met them on their journey is obviously after the fact. And
right.
I really wanted to emphasize what did they do? What helped them? Like, how can we pay it forward with this project, but with their stories? And naturally, each of them had something or someone or a combination of things that were helpful to them and resources. And so through the evolution of this project, it just kind of became more and more clear that, wow, look at how they did it. Look at how Trish did it. Look at how Maha did it. Look at how Adrian did it. It looks different, but let's really lean in and showcase that. You know, I don't want to glamorize the act of abuse, and I really want to give these women their screen time and their time to share these stories, because we don't hear from the women as much as we should. We always hear, you know, from the other side of things, and I thought it was really important to take up space for them to be on screen sharing their story from their perspective and not having, you know, it be taking down a murder mystery or a true crime lens. Mm-hmm. I really wanted it to be for them and how they see it and how they wanted to share and what they wanted to share.
Now, did you think about bringing other women, other survivors and thrivers into the documentary? You do have some wonderful, it's like Trish's best friend, her BFF, mm-hmm. is just amazing.
Yeah.
Everybody needs a BFF like her.
We do. We all need her.
We all need her.
We all need her.
Did you think about adding more women to this? Because you do have some professionals in there that we get interviews from. But these survivors and thrivers, or did you really want to just hone it in on these three?
I think it became very clear in post-production, especially because of the pandemic changing the statistic of 1 in 4 women to 1 in 3,
mm-hmm.
that I felt like even using the 3 was very symbolic and kind of pushes that statistic more to the forefront and really use that as a guide. And I felt like that was very beautiful and harrowing. But like you're saying, this project could be an ongoing series,
yeah.
right? Like there are so many stories. There are so many different approaches, so many different angles, perspectives. This definitely is just a tiny, tiny glimpse, you know, into it. It's not all encompassing. I definitely think this project could be an ongoing.
Oh, absolutely. As I was watching it, the first thing I thought was series.
Yes.
The first thing I thought was series, with an investigative slant to it, but with the uplifting, inspiring perspective, you know, and versus the abuser.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I would have loved to incorporate more. It's just a matter of you have to work with what you've got, and you can only, you've got to stop yourself at one point. You know, the art is never complete, but I definitely think that this project has a lot of potential to be a continuation in the future and to really get more and more stories incorporated.
Now, once you figured out what you were going to do, and you had your, you know, Maha, Adrian, Trish lined up, and then I'm sure Trish had something to do with bringing in some of the experts. I'm just figuring that Trish is the one that led you down that path to bring the experts in.
We actually met Rachel Lee Snyder as our kind of through, you know, wide worldview expert.
Mm-hmm.
We actually met at a book signing of hers, which was No Visible Bruises, that she wrote. And that was locally in Westchester through a lady that I know from networking in the community. And so that was also just another example of the serendipity of this project. You know, we went up to her and we were like, hey, we're doing this project. We would love for you to be involved. We love the work that you're doing. Your book title is almost our title.
Yeah.
we just would love to see if we can talk with you. And she was in town only, you know, another week, and we made her interview happen, and were able to incorporate her. And then the other experts, Judge was through Maha, and Moana was also locally connected to us. And it just, yeah, I mean, Trish definitely helped with bringing all of her experts in, especially the doctor perspective, which we thought was really important to include. And yeah, the other experts, we really leaned into the universe for this. I feel like there was something meant for it, for those people to be involved, and we somehow made it all happen.
I love that you brought a doctor's perspective into this. I love that you brought that in, because that's an aspect people never think about.
Mm.
And that's actually the medical aspect, not, yes, we have the psychological, psychiatric aspect, but the medical aspect. And that's something we have never heard about.
Yeah.
And I love that you brought him in. Now, did you accumulate all of your experts and your interview subjects first? Did you start shooting first? What was your production and directorial roadmap here?
Yeah, we did actually have, we had all of our interviews lined up. We filmed all the women first, and then we had the additional supplemental interviews for each lady's story. So we had Trish's lined up, then we had Maha's and Adrian's, and we all were able to go and film them in you know, a couple days, different cities, different locations. But we had them all lined up, because we really, after we had their initial interview, it is very clear how those supplemental interviews were going to tie in to support each of the ladies' stories.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have to give credit and kudos to your editor, to Sarah Franke. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Sarah has done such an amazing job, number one, with the through line that the two of you have developed, so that everything, it's cogent, it's coherent, and it takes us on a journey. And you build and build and build. You very smartly the story we're really hearing at the beginning is Maha's story, which is, it is really a very traumatic and, as I said earlier, shocking, unbelievable story that most people are not going to go through that. Hopefully, hopefully. And you start with that, and then you start the building blocks for recovery, for that survival and resilience. And you keep going from there. But I love the pacing you've developed, particularly where you're inserting your experts in between the stories of these three primary your women, Maha, Adrian, and Trish. What was this editing process like for you and Sarah? Were you editing as you went, wait till the end, or just throw your hands up and go, I'll come back to this in 6 months?
No, so I am so, so thankful for Sarah. When I brought Sarah on board, I had developed, you know, my paper cut, my version of each of the stories. I had in mind that I wanted to utilize the wave imagery and the metaphor that Adrian so beautifully describes as the cycle, and use that to be the chaos, but also the strength and the power that these women hold. And so we started with, you know, the big crazy paper cut document, and we really just whittled it down and whittled it down, went back and forth with each other in post-production. Sarah would find creative ways to use like audio and things, and we would go back and forth and say, okay, well, maybe let's not show this part, maybe let's listen here. And really find that. And then as we got closer and closer to narrowing down each of the ladies' stories, we realized that we really needed to incorporate breathing room, and we wanted to give the audience time to digest in between the stories as well, because it's traumatizing. It can be triggering for a lot of people. And I wanted to give breathing room and space for people to process before taking them on, and really just use that ebb and flow wave kind of feeling to give us a nice back and forth.
Well, another thing that I kept thinking of with the waves, with the interstitials, with the water, is water, you think of baptismal, cleansing, starting anew. And that's really, that was the big thing that I was getting with the introduction, the interstitials of water.
Was the rebirth.
The rebirth.
Yes.
Because that's essentially what they have all done. They have been reborn after these traumatic events. But I love, and yes, I see the whole ebb and flow, but I personally, I like the whole idea of them being reborn, starting afresh. It's clean.
Yeah.
You know, it's clean.
It is. It's kind of a great equalizer also. It's like water gives life and takes it away as well. So it plays into that larger, you know, cycle of abuse, and also how these women are emerging, you know, just the motion of the ocean, like they are emerging anew.
So now what would you say was the most challenging aspect of making Scars Unseen? Besides coming up with money,
besides fundraising.
That's a given. That's a given, people.
Yes. That's a given. Honestly, I think getting from raising funds for post-production to a finished product was probably the most emotionally and physically draining. I loved the post-production process, and working with Sarah and our composers changed, you know, the game for me. But that was really the most challenging part, was reliving these stories with each of them and figuring out what to take out. That was really, really hard for me to kind of whittle their stories down, because I kept going back and forth, you know, what to leave in, what not to leave in. And just be very cognizant of who we're talking about, how we're talking about them, and to just really, really be careful and cautious as to how we portrayed each person in each interview. I think that was, it was challenging, but I really enjoyed that challenge.
Now, what would, this is your first feature, Doc.
Yes.
What are the greatest lessons that you learned in making this documentary, doing a feature that you can now take forward into future work?
Mm-hmm.
Will you venture into features again?
Yes, I'm in the process right now. I can't help myself. I'm also in development on my second feature documentary. This has been the greatest learning experience for me. Like most people, it's like until you've done it once, it's hard. Once you've done it, you can replicate it, right? Or you can adjust, you can adapt, mm-hmm. you can learn from your mistakes or what you would have done differently. So I'm very fortunate to have seen this project all the way through to where it is now. I would say some really big key takeaways for me is that really thinking about the exhibition of the project before you even start filming, and looking at potential partner opportunities, especially if it's a social justice oriented documentary, like making those relationships early and developing from, okay, I want it to be, say, in universities with a curriculum, or with partner organizations to do panels and workshops, or some of the healing techniques, and kind of work your way backwards, thinking about where the project is going to be eventually, and incorporate those people in that community in the process. That's something that's definitely huge and something that I'm working on incorporating into my next one. And the other thing is that I've learned once you've finished, you're about halfway done. if that. So really just have that mindset of patience as well. And that, you know, it does take time, and it is a very long process, especially for documentaries. But to be aware that you probably will have to fundraise at every stage unless you're fortunate enough to secure enough funding at the get-go. But to be just aware and not think of fundraising as like a one and done, but really think of it as a process as well, and be prepared to just go out again and again and again and get what you need in order to get your project finished. And definitely think about those partners early on.
Now, thinking about fundraising at the different stages, mm-hmm. do you find that a more perhaps beneficial way to do your funding? Because it gives you a better idea instead of doing one massive budget to start with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know how much footage you have. You know how, you know what you have with editing. Okay, then we've got to do color correction. We've got to do this. But as you whittle down from the big picture, mm-hmm. does that give you a better economic understanding of what you actually are going to need
mm-hmm.
to get something done? Or is just one big, you know, here's $50,000, go run with it. Is that the best way to go?
I think it depends on the project, but definitely I think breaking it up has different benefits. Like I think, like you're saying, knowing maybe you might not need what you thought you initially needed, or maybe you need something different and that cost is going to be different. So kind of having that flexibility to adapt, if you break it up into segments for fundraising, that can also be helpful. And chances are those are smaller amounts, so you might have an easier time finding a grant that fits that, or finding a donor or a couple donors along the way. And then also keeping in mind the fundraising element, that's another good way to continuously be talking about your project at the different stages, right? Like you can bring in new people, new audience members, and different folks that will want to support you now. Maybe you're in post-production, maybe you're just about to start, but that also want to see this completed. So then they're already now invested in you again at the different stage, you know? So just kind of keeping that conversation open. And I think we all know it takes a village. So the more people on your side, the better.
Now, any chance that after Dances with Films, number one, do you have more festivals, you know, coming down the pike? But any chance that you might go back and if you get some interest from a distributor, be it for television, be it for film, that you would go back and recut and reinsert some of your darlings that you had to kill in the process of making Scars Unseen?
That's a great question. We do have a couple film festivals coming up. We'll be in, I'm not sure if I'm even allowed to say yet, but we will be coming up.
Then don't.
To a couple, one in August and one in October for sure, confirmed. And then to your question, also, we are looking to, you know, start a community screening tour of sorts and work with other organizations to bring this film to first responders and to organizations and people that encounter this, these domestic violence situations, like on their daily basis in their work lives as well, as well as bring it to universities and really start that dialogue and use this film as kind of a catalyst to start those conversations and to open up that door. As far as distribution and bringing back some darlings, it totally depends. We definitely want this film to be seen, and I'm happy to have those conversations.
Well, I can't wait to see the reception for Scars Unseen. Your world premiere is the 30th at 2:45 in the afternoon at the TCL Man's Chinese upstairs. I still call it Man's sometimes. just like it's always going to be the Chinese Theater, not the TCL
yes.
Chinese Theater. It's the Grauman's Chinese Theater. But any idea how the ticket sales are for this one yet?
I think we've still got some available. We've definitely sold a lot, but if you're listening and want to come on down, definitely purchase your ticket before they go away and come and support Scars Unseen. We'd love to have any of your listeners present.
Oh, Meredith, this has been an absolute joy getting to speak with you and to talk about Scars Unseen. This is an eye-opening viewpoint that we haven't seen before. And I think it's something that will really make people stop and think. And I can't wait to hear the reception that you get next weekend. So
thank you. I am so excited. I'm tingling. So I can't wait. I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me and amplify, you know, this message and this film. And like you're saying, I know this is just the beginning, and I'm excited to hear how it's received.
Well, yeah, and I hope you're going to come back on the show with another film sometime soon.
Oh, I will come back anytime you want.
Oh, Meredith, thank you so much, and have fun at Dances with Films.
Thank you. I'm very excited. It's going to be a fun time.
Thanks, Meredith. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
And that was Meredith Yinger, the writer-director of Scars Unseen. Dances with Films, world premiere, June 30th at 2:45 in the afternoon. And get your tickets, because they do sell out. Trust me, don't just show up at the theater. Go online to Dances with Films, to their website, and you can get tickets to all the films that are there. Another friend of mine, his wife has a film on Wednesday, but he couldn't remember what time, and I can't remember the name of it. But and who knows, maybe next year John's film, John Corcoran, will have his own film at Dances with Films. But right now, let's see, we're looking for, where is Steve Balderson? Don't know where he is. Steve has not called in. I have emailed him. I don't have a response from him. And we just confirmed yesterday again. So I guess we're going to move on. Nothing's ringing, Pam? Nothing's ringing. Okay. So if Steve calls in, I will interrupt. And this really is disappointing, because I really am excited to talk with him about Bloody Famous, because it is just such a fun series on Prime Video. It's right up my alley, and those of you that know my taste on a lot of strange things, sarcasm, satire, it's something that you'll love too. And it's so different for Steve that I really want to talk to him. So hopefully he will answer something. But in the meantime, we're going to switch gears here. And we are going to talk about a film that you heard me mention briefly last week. It is all over the media right now. It is in theaters. It is all about Thelma and June Squibb, action star. I am beyond thrilled. I've had the pleasure of speaking with June over the years in social settings and also as part of film campaigns and press. She is the loveliest lady. No one in a million years would have thought that at 94 years young, June Squibb could be called an action hero, but that is exactly what she is in Thelma. Written, directed, and edited by Josh Margolin, this is a love letter to his own grandmother, Thelma, who I think is 104 and still with us. And it's based on, it's an incident that happened to his grandmother. And he just expounds on it and takes great literary license here. And many of you, you've seen the ads, you've seen the trailers, you've seen the promos of June Squibb as Thelma riding around in an electric scooter. She did all of that herself in the course of the film. She and Richard Roundtree, which this is also his swan song. It is just a fun, fun movie as Thelma, who has been swindled out of $10,000 by a phone scam. She wants her money back, and she's going to get it. And she enlists a little bit of help from her grandson, who's beautifully played by Fred Hechinger. Daniel needs to learn responsibility in life. Thelma needs help with computers. You know, grandmother, grandson, it's always a match made in heaven. But this is Josh's feature directorial debut. It is just, there aren't enough words of praise for Thelma. Action film, screwball comedy, a buddy road trip, and the love of a grandmother and grandson. And the whole idea that don't write off old people. We will get you. We will do it. Just fabulous. Down to the music. Josh and I cover everything in this interview, so take a listen to my exclusive interview with writer, director, editor Josh Margolin talking about the fabulous Thelma. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Debbie. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. I can't tell you how much I love Thelma. It is such a joy. And for me, who my grandmother was everything in the world to me, and I can see it, that's the same with you and what you've done with Thelma.
Thank you. I'm so happy to hear that. Thank you so much.
For you to make a film like Thelma and really focus on your grandmother, and you name the character after your grandmother, you shot in her condo, her house, your love comes through beginning to end. And any guy that will do that with a film is okay by me.
I'm so glad.
The film, it's warm, it's wonderful, it's fun, it's funny. And it's a great sentimental journey of action and aging. And boy, oh boy, you made June Squibb an action hero. Yay!
That's what we've all been waiting for.
I'll tell you, as many years as I've chatted off and on with June, until Nebraska, she's been relegated to the background. But now you've got her here front and center, and then you partner her up with another geriatric friend, Richard Roundtree, a beautifully poignant final performance for him in his career. And the meld that you have with Fred Hechinger's character of Daniel, that magic of Daniel and Thelma, everything about this film, Josh, is just spectacular. It is a pure delight.
Thank you. That's so kind of you to say. Thank you so much.
What, and so many of the things that I see unfolding, Thelma trying to learn a computer, or her dispensing advice, Grand Daniel's trying to teach her about the computer and phone scams and things like this. She's trying to teach him about kindness and responsibility in a very wonderful grandmotherly way. These are things we don't see on screen anymore, Josh. We just don't see them.
And yeah, no, it's true. There's probably not as many movies sort of centering that kind of relationship.
No. And that is one of the really refreshing, wonderful things about Thelma, because it's going to appeal to multiple generations and maybe give them some kind of compass within themselves. But I'm curious, they always say write about what you know. Obviously, you know your grandmother. But what made you want to tell this story and pull from her life and your relationship with her?
Well, you know, so she's always been such a huge presence in my life, and you were right to pick up on the love there and the closeness, because yeah, she's just been, you know, someone who I've always felt very close to and just had kind of a kindredness with ever since I was a kid. And this, you know, she was living alone in her 90s after my grandpa died, and it was the first time she had ever lived alone and you know, her whole life, basically, and especially after her 70-year marriage. And during that time, she got a call, basically, that was a lot like this one that sets off the movie, where someone was pretending to be me, saying I'd been in a car accident and hit someone and I needed to be bailed out. And she got really panicked, and my parents got really panicked. And luckily, we were able to intervene, and they tracked me down before she sent any money. But it really got me thinking about kind of the moment she was in, where she was, you know, I think both grieving but also relishing her independence for the first time and this kind of new moment in life, but also coming up against kind of, you know, aging and the things that she had kind of beaten off and survived and dodged in different ways over the many years. And it sort of shook me up, I think, just to see her kind of duped that way, and especially with me as the bait. So I started imagining what might have happened if she had sent the money and if she had gone to get it back. And it became an excuse to write an ode to her grit and her strength and her tenacity, and also to explore, you know, aging and anxiety and a lot of the things on my mind at the time, and maybe always. So it just, it was a, you know, an incident that kind of spurred an idea that let me explore and think about some of these things that were sort of top of mind at the time. And as, especially as she was like entering this new phase of her life and I was kind of entering a new phase of my own.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the great things with the script, with the story, Josh, is the multi-generational aspect of it. Because we've got Daniel, and then we've got Daniel's parents, Alan and Gail, and we've got Grandma Thelma. So we're covering the entire spectrum of the age demographic here. And you really capture each age bracket so perfectly. How important was that to you to really set out the different mindsets of these three generations?
I'm glad to hear that. Very important. I think I like to say that it's not a movie about old age necessarily as much as it's a movie about aging. And all of these characters are going through these transitional moments, whether it's, you know, Thelma facing what she's facing, or Daniel kind of reckoning with his own autonomy and independence at a different moment in life. And the parents kind of caught in between, you know, concerned about both parties in different ways and kind of, you know, driven into a bit of a frenzy as they try to navigate those two poles. So it's definitely, I hope that each perspective would feel sort of relatable and specific and could all kind of feed each other and serve as different threads of sort of the same larger thought about how we, you know, take care of ourselves, how we take care of each other, how we hold on to our independence and our autonomy, but also how we kind of bend and adapt as life changes and the people around us have different needs and we have different needs. So I really was hoping to kind of, yeah, try to really hit all of those perspectives, because I do think it's something that everybody in my family, certainly, I've seen experience through, you know, these different moments.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. I've seen it in mine too over the decades. And, you definitely struck a great chord of honesty and authenticity in doing that. So
thank you. That was the hope, inspiration for sure.
Yeah, you nailed that. Now, you've got this great story. You have these incredible actors, this cast, your first feature directorial, and you get a cast like this. My God, just an embarrassment of riches for you, Josh.
It was. It really was.
But you also carried over the excellence of the story, your character development, and your performances, your actors, into your production values. I've got to tell you, David Bolin is your DP. Really nice, nice job with the lighting and the lensing as we go around L.A. You keep your visual tonal bandwidth really light and bright. That translates into the emotional tonal bandwidth that's coming from your characters and from the performances. What were your thoughts in working with David as your cinematographer in designing your lighting and lensing, bearing in mind that you are the one who's also going to be editing this?
Yes, true. David was a real dream to work with. He's such a talented DP, and what's great about him, besides being a really nice, smart guy and a great DP, is that he has worked in both narrative and in doc.
Mm-hmm.
So he's kind of this interesting hybrid of both being really, really detail-oriented and being really, really sort of cinematically minded, but also being really adaptable and being really humane and somebody who really has a lot of sensitivity for how to sort of light from a place of feeling, which is something we talked about a lot. And I think, you know, we both sort of shot-listed the movie top to bottom just to make sure we really understood what we were doing from a slightly more logistical standpoint, and especially with some of the action stuff and how we were going to kind of set up a visual language that could grow and evolve as the movie goes on. But on the flip side, we both, I think, because we did so much prep, felt okay to sort of let things go sometimes when they weren't working or when they were feeling kind of tortured or overly complicated. And, you know, David has so many great instincts too in the moment. So I feel like it was a really, really lovely process with him in us both wanting to be really prepared and also both being really adaptable to kind of say, hey, this is feeling off or this is feeling forced or, you know, something's too busy here. Let's simplify. And I think more often than not, simplifying felt right. And he was really, I love David. He was an absolute, you know, joy and gift to the movie.
And something that you both keenly do is there are so many directors or cinematographers that would have kept the POV, the eye line, equivalent with if we're walking around a room. You bring your eye line down. Once Thelma and Ben get into the electric cart and go tooling all over Los Angeles, you bring the camera down so that we have their eye line. You give us a lot of great overhead drone to give us a lay of the land in Los Angeles. For those of us that know the area, we know where they are and where they should not really be. But I love that you give us the eyeline perspective of them sitting in the electric cart, especially when they're playing chicken in the hall of the nursing home.
Oh, I'm glad, yeah.
That really adds so much because so easily it could have been people are looking down on them because they're seniors. But by bringing the camera down, you alleviate that problem.
I'm really glad to hear that. That was really important to us, just from a tonal perspective, to want to make sure the movie was always with them and never looking down on anyone, never punching down, but aligning with them and sort of being sensitive to them and being in their perspective as much as we could be, you know, sometimes literally and more often kind of just subjectively and in the feeling of the shots, because, you know, I think the movie works best when you're on the ride with her, when you're buying into the journey. And I think the tone, if it gets too broad or it gets too silly or it goes for easy punchlines, can very quickly lose that feeling and that thread. And, you know, the tone, to your point, was just always really, really an important piece of the puzzle. And I'm so glad that you feel, you know, visually was communicated in that way too.
Very much so. And of course, here you are, you've got action with some adventure, you've got comedy, you've got screwball comedy, thanks to Clark and Parker, and you're taking us on a buddy road trip and then you got to edit all of this together. How challenging was your editing process for Thelma? Were you editing as you went? Do you had all your footage assembled and then start editing? What was that process like? Because you're melding so many things here, and you do it so beautifully.
Thank you. I was not editing as I went. I definitely didn't really dive in until after the shoot. I think I took about a week away and just to, you know, get my head right and then started diving in. But it was, you know, everything I've made, I've always edited. So it feels like such a natural part of the process to me. Like, I really enjoy the process of editing. I find it really satisfying and fun. But that said, you know, it definitely felt like an undertaking as well. And I think to your point, trying to make sure all of those different threads and all of those different stories and all of those different, you know, flavors blended together properly, honestly just took time, I think. You know, the first cut came together decently quickly, and was sort of, you know, very much to script and felt solid. You know, it felt like, okay, there's stuff to do, but okay, we have, the movie exists, thank God. We shot what we needed to shoot. I would say the process was, we had a lot of time, interestingly. We sort of shot off-season for, like, festival submissions. So we had, you know, shy of a year in post, but we had some time to tinker. And I think the thing that was really helpful in making it its best self was basically kind of hunkering down in the cave for a bit, working on it, and then showing it to my producers, Zoe and Chris, showing it to the wider team, showing it to our friends and family, like getting trusted eyeballs on it at different moments in the process and getting feedback and then kind of processing that and going back in, I think was really, really helpful in just making sure the things that, you know, we hope were connecting and that we weren't losing the forest for the trees and we were, you know, willing to kill some darlings along the way, which is, you know, if you have to kill something you love for the sake of the larger movie, it's okay, because I think, you know, the thing I love most is making the movie work. And if sometimes that means losing something that is, you know, a detail that I have affection for, but isn't serving the overall mission, then that was helpful to get context for. So for me, it was a process of kind of like zooming in and zooming out, like doing a lot of the micro detail work, kind of off instinct and off of, oh, this feels good, this feels right, and then kind of taking a step back and getting perspective. And we also had one session with a great editor named Chris Donlin, who came in for a day or two at the end of the process to just kind of be an outside set of eyes, and that was super helpful as well.
I've got to ask one more question here, Josh, about the music, the score. Mission Impossible notes, Matt Helm notes, my God. What were you and Nick looking for musically in developing the score for Thelma?
You know, we were looking for something that felt, you know, organic and kind of tactile feeling, but also propulsive and also kind of melancholy at times. We wanted something that felt, like, Nick puts this really well. He says we wanted to score the movie from her point of view. We wanted it to feel like an action movie from her point of view. So the music was always sized to the movie properly, because it was another thing where it was easy to, you know, if you go too big, it feels like a parody. If you go too small, it's not repulsive enough. So it was about finding instruments, finding sounds, finding enough personality and character in it, but also finding enough propulsion and energy. So, you know, Lalo Schifrin was a big reference point for Nick in his movie kind of conception of it. And, you know, we ended up doing a lot of live instrument sessions and Nick cut those up and, you know, fashioned the score out of a lot of live elements too, which was really, really fun to play with. So, you know, we wanted it to be Mission Impossible, but for the scope and scale of what was needed and you know, be able to kind of stretch into the emotional bits as well.
You just succeeded on every level with this one, Josh. I loved it from beginning to end. You made June Squibb an action hero. Just so well done. And it just reminded me of my grandmother all the way through and some of her antics, like escaping from a nursing home. So well done, Josh. I can't wait to see your follow-up film to this one.
Thank you. Thank you. I'll keep you posted.
Please.
Thank you so much. Seriously.
Please do. And hopefully we'll chat again in the future.
Absolutely. I would love that.
Thanks so much, Josh. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
And that was writer, director, editor Josh Margolin. My mouth isn't working. Talking about the fantastic Thelma in theaters now. You will not be disappointed. This is truly one of my favorite films of the year. How can you not love June Squibb? And I'm not revealing who the villainous person is. Some of you may already know if you've seen the film or if people have had big mouths, but the villainous person who scammed her, Thelma out of 10 grand, it's a great reveal, a great reveal. But on every level, so much fun. Go see it, people. It's great. Now, he was missing in action. He has been found. And now, are you still there, Steve, or did you go missing again?
I'm here.
It is the man himself, Steve Balderson. He has been found, and he is here with us. And yes, people, we are intentionally, purposefully running the show late today just to have Steve on, since he was missing and forgot all about us and didn't call in till a few minutes ago. So am I guilting you enough?
Yes.
Good. Well, number one, I don't know if you're looking at the Adrenaline Radio Facebook page with Nick's Vimeo whatever thingy he does with video that I hate. But anybody that's looking on the tablescape today are two of your prior books, Filmmaking Confidential and How to Find Investors, and you have been on the show talking about those once on Filmmaking Confidential, once you were here for Investors, and once you were here for Alchemy of the Spirit. And the hysterical part is my Filmmaking Confidential copy, it still has over 60 post-it notes in it.
Amazing.
That I had marked up in the book with all the salient points in there for when filmmakers will ask me questions about, oh, well, what do I do? What am I supposed to do? And I go to your book. And I can pull things out. But yeah, all of my multicolored posters, that's the first thing Pam noticed today when I set up the tablescape. And she goes, oh my God, look at all those post-its. I still the same ones, but a very handy book. So I say again to filmmakers out there, especially new filmmakers, get a copy. Filmmaking Confidential. It's on Amazon. Get it. You will not regret it. But now, you're venturing into new territory now, my friend, with a streaming series.
Yes.
Bloody Famous. This is divinely delicious. It is satiric. It is wicked. It is wild. You don't know what's coming next. It is The Bachelorette meets The Hunger Games to the nth degree. I just loved it from beginning to end. You've got four episodes. They're roughly about 40, 45 minutes each. And just so much fun. Where did you come up with the idea for Bloody Famous?
Well, it was written by my friend Elizabeth Speer, and she had done her dissertation on The Bachelor and The Bachelorette.
Oh, my God.
When she was in university. So she knew all the tropes to play with, and I just kind of let her do what she wanted to do. And when I got the script, I was like, oh, my God, this is insane. Like, you know. And I wanted to do something completely different than Alchemy of the Spirit. Typically, when I finish doing a movie or any kind of project, I want to do the complete opposite.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to do something ridiculous and also to poke fun at the fame hungry world that we live in, and it was a lot of fun to do it.
It is hilarious. And your premise, you have this singer, you know, she's a singer, she's not Taylor Swift famous, but she's a singer, and she ends up shooting her ex-boyfriend. And somehow the media, of course, they have a field day with this. She becomes known as a Black Widow. And, of course, some savvy reality producers out there decide, this would be a really cool reality show. Let's have the Black Widow on, trying to find love, and then kill off the guys as she rejects them.
Totally.
And how can you not love that premise? And in the first...
I think it should be... The series, I mean, it could go on and on and on. I mean, I would watch it.
Okay.
Even if I had nothing to do with it.
Okay. I already want to know if there's going to be a season two, because you have it set up perfectly for a season two. But I want you to know, spread out here in front of me on the desk, I have 10 pages of notes that I took watching the four episodes. 10 pages, Steve.
Amazing.
Starting with, we meet Amira, our heroine Amira, who is brilliantly played by Tamara Alcid. I mean, she's wonderful as Amira.
Yeah.
But then we meet each of the guys. We've got DeMarcus, a self-proclaimed singer who actually can sing, as we see as the series goes on. Double X or Triple X Xavier, who is just a creepy doofus. We've got Jeremy, the creepy, half-naked, oily hands, just masseuse. We've got Felix, the video gamer, who it's a wonder he even has eyes left in his head from all his video gaming. We've got Marcus, the fitness trainer and hawker of pee-pee. We have Julian, a nurse, and he carries around his CPR half-mannequin. Amir, who only wants to give his parents grandchildren and who has already bought a house for Amira, knowing she will pick him as her true love. We have Raul, who's in the military, and he's appearing on Zoom. But we've got Bo, who is God only knows what he is, but skeevy. He's a designer. He does his own shows. He designs his own clothes. He's going to impress Amira and design a dress for her. He presents her with a sketch of a dress. But this guy is cutthroat, nasty, and I want to know how much black dye he put in his hair. And then we...
It's real.
It's... Oh, my God.
I know.
That's scary. That's scary. That's like Halloween black shoe dye scary. Then we got Jeremy B. He's kind of semi-normal. He's a tattoo artist. He's really sweet. And then we have the brains behind this whole Black Widow concept of a reality show, Eddie, the producer, and Nigel, the host. Nigel's really a slovenly pig as a host. And Eddie is just, she's totally twisted and demented. And then the poor guy we never get to see, Kevin, the cameraman guy. Who is so much fun.
Yeah.
I like Kevin. Now,
Kevin was my favorite.
I like Kevin. But I kept wondering, well, why wasn't she like going to, you know, maybe she'd be attracted to Kevin, the camera guy. But you didn't know. It didn't happen that way. But we start with the individual little, ha ha, hi guys. And they give their little sales pitch, which if ever anybody goes to your YouTube channel, you have the individual intro videos for each one of the guys that people can watch. Set out. They're incorporated within the series itself, but you can watch them individually and you can have a lot of fun and really, really get the satire and the humor that that just leaps off the screen at you with some of these guys. Let me tell you. But the whole thing is, it's like, we're going to try and find some connection within this web. The whole thing, it's a cobweb. The house is where they all hook up. It's a cobweb. She's the spider, and they're all the little flies that she lures in. And what is this whole hourglass thing? It's like everybody gets a little hourglass, and she spins the hourglass. Is your time up, or do the sands keep running for you?
Totally.
What's with the hourglass thing? How did you come up with that? You and Elizabeth come up with that?
Well, we needed some kind of thing to, you know, indicate, you know, like on The Bachelorette when they have like the roses.
Yeah.
And we thought of the red hourglass that's on the Black Widow spider.
Okay.
And so we thought, oh, that would be a good symbol.
It looks cool.
It is.
It really looks cool. You know, you could do swag along with the series and, you know, sell those little hourglass cobwebs.
They were hard to make. We have, I think I still have a number of them left.
I mean, people would buy those things because they are so cool.
I think so.
Yeah. You got time before Halloween. I'm telling you.
I'll get on it.
You should, at least for me. And we move through the episodes. We've got episode 1, Love or Die Trying. Episode 2, Reality Bites. We're catching up with the guys. We get more behind-the-scenes stuff inserted. I love how your inserts of behind-the-scenes you do in black and white. I also like the fact that it's done through Kevin's, the monitor on his camera. And we can always see in the upper right corner how much battery time he has left.
yeah.
So we've got green, we've got red, and you can tell when it's red, it's because, okay, we really do need this to end. Because there's like a big reveal or something, or it's a cliffhanger. So I really love that whole thing. You also have interstitials of the public who rabidly watch this, and there are these contests every week. Okay, what's the percentage? How many think that Amira should be with Raul? How many think she should be with a creepy, half-naked, oily hands Jeremy? And it's so funny. And you get the man on the street, the Jimmy Kimmel kind of reactions to things. It's just so well done as we start going through all of this. And we have party time. And we see just how really sleazy some of these guys are. But you also give us the whole behind the scenes with producers and how they manipulate. This is one of my favorite things where they're giving a script to Amira. They're scripting the guys. And you're peeling back the onion on that with a very satiric comedic slant. And that is so much fun. And tying into that is, you know, when we've got Eddie talking about manipulating Amir, talking about naked ass Jeremy, and she wants Jeremy B eliminated. And she talks about, you've got a great line in here, murder is a big responsibility. And I busted a gut. I mean, it's just, it goes on and on. How do you... And we just keep building up, and then the guys are dropping like flies in various means. And I'm not going to say who, but I will say you have included the time-honored tradition of bobbitization.
Yep.
That truly, I was hoping to see that, and I did. So
you amazing.
You made me happy. How do you have this great script with Elizabeth. How do you even start approaching this to break it down from a directorial standpoint in terms of your production elements, your production design, a large ensemble cast, and differentiating between the bright lights of a studio / cobweb house and opting to go with black and white for the behind the scenes stuff? Walk me through your process on this one, because this is unlike anything you've done before with your narrative features.
Yes, it was really complex. But when I tried to describe it to people, I said, okay, think of it from three different perspectives. So we as an audience are watching Bloody Famous. Mm-hmm. And then we are watching the making of the show Black Widow.
Mm-hmm.
Which goes, it's a little bit of a mesh, because a lot of the times we're actually watching the show Black Widow while we're watching Bloody Famous.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the perspective of the camera that's shooting Bloody Famous is also the camera that's shooting Black Widow. And then there's Kevin's camera, which is its own
entity
section. And it was so much fun. But it was also incredibly complicated to cast. It was the first time that I'd ever used breakdown services or Actors Access, where you just sort of post a broadcasting call.
Mm-hmm.
And I was amazed by how many actually talented people there are out there that we don't see. And it was really, really hard. You know, I would get it down to three or four guys for each one of those parts. And some of the guys who had auditions for one part, I ended up casting in a different part than the one that they had auditioned for based on their personalities. Like, for instance, Jackass Jeremy is actually a super sweet, nice human being. So it's like he's playing against his natural type. But as soon as I could see that part of him, I was like, oh, no, you are totally that gross guy. And I don't know, it was super complicated. But for me, I went about it no differently than making a movie. It was just a longer one.
Mm-hmm.
So the shoot was the same. It was just twice as long. Or the shooting days were the same as shooting a film. It was a lot longer. We shot more footage than we would normally on a feature because I wanted to film it as a reality show. So I would say most of it was scripted, but there are a lot of improv elements in it where I just let the cast just kind of go with it.
Oh, wow.
And they were all really good at improv.
Wow. Now, I'm curious, because we have kills in here, since that's the whole premise. She kills them as they get sliced from the show. Did you do shot listing? Did you do storyboards for those? Because some of those kills are quite intense as to what we're seeing on screen.
Yes, we had to break it down because the special effects would have to be done, you know, in the middle of shooting the scene. So we would have to shoot something and then really tick off the boxes of the storyboards so that we would know exactly what we were looking at when we were looking at it.
You know, and of course, you even got scenes involving helicopters and rescues and, you know, some fun stuff that gets very explosive. And I imagine that a lot of that took a lot of planning. You've got some rooftop scenes in here that require planning. You've got some really intricate elements to this, and that surprised me. Episode one, I'm figuring, okay, you know, this is going to be a lot of fun. But then I'm seeing the intricacy of the production.
Yeah.
That you've gone through. Now, as you were shooting, did you try shooting this chronologically? Did you shoot this the way something is normally shot, haphazardly and planned out, get all of the blood done in one day and all of this or all of that? Or because you're ticking off guys one by one, did you kind of have to go chronologically?
Well, we did chronologically based on location. So we were in the house, and we would shoot everything chronologically in the house before we would move to a different set location.
Okay.
And then once we were in the new place, like the motel or the high rise or the roof or whatever, we would shoot everything sequentially as it happened then, or at that location. So it was a little out of order, but primarily in order by which things happened.
Wow. Now, did you have any idea that this would be four episodes when you started this? Or how did the whole episodic breakdown come to be, Steve?
Well, we knew it would be episodic, but I didn't know how many.
Right.
And so when we were editing, that's when it really sort of came together. And when I noticed that there was just sort of a natural break, like a cliffhanger-y break at about the 40, 45-minute mark, I thought, okay, that's the length of this episode. And then it just so happened that 45 minutes later was the next natural break. Mm-hmm. And then we came up with four. But had it been a little longer, I mean, we could have probably squeezed another two episodes out of it or made them shorter to have different episodes. But I liked the way that each one just happened to find a good ending at around that time mark.
No, I like the pacing of it and those natural breaks. It feels very soapy, very much like a soap opera. When each one ends, it is a cliffhanger to a degree. And you definitely, you're going to binge it and you're going to want to see the next episode right away. There's absolutely no doubt about it. Especially as we're getting into things like where they're pressuring Amira and we need your list of who you want to have stay, who you want to have go. But nobody's listening to her list anyway. So it's like, why bother? And then the public feedback that we keep getting. There are so many things that it has a natural feel to it, especially when we get into episode 3. That's a really, really charged episode.
Yeah.
Episode 3. And I love how it does end. It has one of my favorite moments in the entire series, without saying what it is, just because I think it's hilarious.
Totally.
But, yeah, and you know which one that is for me. So
I do.
But episode 3, it's also, we see some really dark sides of some of the guys. And
yeah,
that's some, and there's some great subtext going on here with your dialogue about how Amira's being treated, how Eddie and Nigel, it's like, they don't care. Envelopes are pushed a little too far in terms of violence towards her by guys, and they don't care. It's really interesting, but it's this subtext in there that for those people that are addicted to something like The Bachelor or The Bachelorette, you have to be thinking this as to what's going on behind the scenes. And what is the contestant not comfortable with that you're ignoring? Or what is happening that you're ignoring? So I really like that subtext that you have happening here. And the way you let things play out. You don't, this I found interesting, you never cut scenes short. You don't cut sequences or scenes short. You've also got, when it comes to Beau, Mr. Egomaniacal, you know, 5 tons of black grease in his hair, even though it's supposedly real. You've got some great, you've got a great visual effects sequence in episode 3 with 5 images of Beau on a screen. And it's chilling. It looks really great. But it also kind of is telling us metaphorically who this guy really is. You talk about the 3 faces of Eve. We got the 5 faces of Beau.
Totally.
So I love those breakdowns. I love how those visual cues come in, which is why I'm curious why, when you were coming up with the visuals for this, were you sketching out any ideas for what you wanted in terms of production design or the visual effects? You do have a lot of fun visual effects happening in here. That one is a very important, very metaphoric standout for me. The one in episode 3 with Beau. But were you envisioning a lot of these little extras and the interstitials as you were going? Or did that all come into play in post?
Well, it was part of the script, so it was there. And I sort of had an idea how I wanted it to look. And I built something, kind of a mock-up in Photoshop. And then when I had the CGI motion graphics people do it, they just hit it out of the park the very first time. It's like the very first version I got back from them. I thought, exactly, that's exactly what we wanted. And so we didn't really, it wasn't that, it was challenging to do, but it wasn't, it was pretty easy that they just got what I was going for right away.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's because you got a good crew. You picked good
totally.
People to do
it. Totally.
It
was so much fun.
And, of course, something else, you do a great interstitial with stars in the sky, a jet black sky, bright white twinkly stars, that's just absolutely gorgeous. And that plays into a whole element of Amira naming a star for one of her potential loves. So you got gushy stuff in there too. You got the lovey-dovey gushy stuff too.
Totally.
But I love the starry sky. And you bring back that pops up more than once in episodes 3 and 4. And it's a lot of, it's beautiful to see it. It's a nice breather, actually. And it throws us off kilter for what's coming. And what happens. Because we get the nice star, the nice, beautiful thing. And then we get Jackass Jeremy interrupting things. I love the interruptions. You have timed on your editing, you have timed these interruptions with the guys trying to interrupt each other when they're having one-on-one time. And there's so much comedy in that, Steve. So much comedy. And the timing is so perfect. Were those improv moments, were those scripted out? Or did you find that in the editing room in terms of that pace, that comedic timing?
A little bit of both. When we were shooting it, I would have a signal, you know, like that I would say, okay, you know, for instance, I would have Jackass watching me, and the second I move my hand, like, come in, then he would, you know, come in and interrupt. And sometimes it was just you felt it intuitively when it should happen, and the mm-hmm. other times were in the editing room.
Because that's just so much fun, is they're cutting each other off, and they're coming in, or they're bemoaning. It's like, my time, it's my time now. Or walk in and say, oh, am I interrupting you? It's just very catty. Very catty.
Totally.
And you expect to see this from women. You don't expect to see it from men. So I like how the shoe is on the other foot here. It just plays so well. Now, how long was the actual shoot on this one?
I want to say it was a good month. I mean, I shoot things pretty quickly.
Yeah,
so
I know
if it's
you
a
do.
Feature, I'd say 2.5 weeks is usually what I average on a feature, two or three weeks. But this maybe was closer to 5, almost 6 weeks, actually.
And then how long was the editing process?
Oh, my God, it took us damn near a year. I mean, because there was so much footage, because I never really wanted to cut. I wanted to always keep going. So we had twice as much footage as we normally would. And from 3 different cameras. So that was the other part. It was a little daunting to do, but we did it, you know, one step at a time. How do you eat an elephant, you know, one bite at a time.
Wow.
But we got it through.
Wow. That's an incredibly long editing process. But I see it's on the screen, though. It's definitely on the screen. The hard work that you put into the editing, it's there. You can feel it in your pace, and you see it in the visuals. Really, just so well done in that regard. What were your thoughts on music for this one?
Well, I wanted to make it fun, and when I was watching, I had never seen The Bachelor or The Bachelorette before. So when I got the script, I had to watch an entire season of each.
I'm so sorry.
Just to get it.
I'm so sorry.
Well, no, it was like a train wreck. When I first started watching it, I couldn't stop watching them. I'm like, why am I still watching this? I've been watching this for 2 hours and I'm still watching this. And when I dissected it, I realized that they're basically, it's nonstop music. And sometimes it would trick me as a viewer. It would toy on my emotions. And when I would rewind it, I would learn that the sound was just underneath audible consciously,
mm-hmm.
but that there was constant music. And the only times it would ever, you know, be super dramatic were in, you know, intense moments where it was made louder. But so I knew that from the beginning, we needed to have constant emotional, persuasive music deliberately, you know, so that when there's like a sweet moment, it's really sweet music. And then when it's dramatic, it's really dramatic. And just basically nonstop, with the exception of key moments where there's no music, which mm-hmm. is the power of the silence.
Mm-hmm. Wow. No, because I love the music. I love the fact that it is omnipresent, but it's not obtrusive, but you get the gist, especially when it goes overly dramatic, when it's time to turn that hourglass.
Totally.
It swells up with all the bass and the drama. And it's like you're waiting for Norman Bates to come popping out at that moment. I really like the sonic balance and the musical balance within that. And another great thing that you do with your sound is the differential between the sound that Kevin's camera is picking up, the sound of the Black Widow show, and the sound in areas like up on the roof. It's very natural ambience, but I like the differential with the softer sounds that the camera itself is just picking up when Kevin is following Amira around versus having the boom mic, you know, there to pick things up for production sound. That's another nice differential touch, and it kind of fits the black and white of Kevin's camera with the behind the scenes. That it's not in the forefront. It's not as loud. It's not colorful. So it truly is. It's behind the lens is what it is. So I really like that and picked up on that immediately in episode one with your first behind the scenes little snippet that we got. Kudos to you on working all working all those elements. Production design is very simple, very basic. You really sprung, you know, you splurged on the budget for those pink plastic champagne glasses, though.
I know, right?
That was, and okay, I don't know if you did Foley or used production sound for this. But when they put the pink plastic down, it was the actual sound of plastic being put down on a tabletop. It wasn't like you tried to Foley in crystal or china or something. No, it was what plastic sounds like, because who doesn't have plastic glassware in their house? Everybody has plastic cups in their house. And we're not talking red Solo beer cups. We're talking like plastic stuff. I got a kick out of that. These little details, Steve, you always bring these little details to life. Maybe it's because I know your filmmaking so well and those things pop out at me, but I really love it. And to see it here over the course of four episodes of fun just made it even more entertaining.
Awesome. Thank you.
So now how has the reception been? Bloody Famous, it's on Prime Video. Everybody can see it.
And it's also free on Tubi.
Is it on Tubi, Mubi? It's on Tubi.
It's free on Tubi, and this is very strange. I have to tell you this.
Yes.
For a few days, about a month or two ago, it was the number one reality show on Tubi in the actual reality show category.
Oh, my
God. Now,
what? What?
Yes. Who? I couldn't. First of all, when it showed up there, I was like, oh my God, someone is watching this and believes it's real.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh.
That was the satire within the satire.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh. So that means
it's a little frightening.
It's really scary because at that point, who knows how many episodes they had watched, but they definitely probably would have watched episode one. And we've got a kill in there. And that's a very subdued kill, actually. It's you know, nothing to speak of. You're not even sure if it's a kill. It's not until a couple more guys start dropping and we start seeing blood or we start seeing accoutrement. That are typically you would think are used in kills, popping up, but wow, that is mind blowing, Steve. Mind blowing that people watched it and they thought that it was a real reality show. It's a very sad.
I mean, I don't know who specifically, but I'm sure there was someone.
But that's twisted. That's...
I mean, I also listened to a podcast recently where somebody went to a convention of flat earthers. And when I was listening to that, I thought, oh my God, there are.
Yeah.
There probably are people who think this is real.
Oh my God. Wow. Yeah. So now that you have ventured into the world of a streaming series, how is that? Does your approach change at all? Does your mindset change between that and features? What was that like for you as a director?
Well, I still love features, and in fact, am in post-production on my next feature, which
Thank
is
God.
A gay love story set in Venice, Italy. And so I still love features. But what I loved was remembering I have in my DNA a true love for serial storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And I had forgotten that when I was really, really young, my father would give me these three-ring or, college-ruled notebooks that were spiral-bound.
Mm-hmm.
And I, at age 8 or something, would draw each piece of paper would be sort of like a graphic novel. It would be a shot of somebody and in the bubble of what their dialogue is, and then you'd turn the page, and it would be the reversed angle on the person they were talking to. And then at the end of each notebook, I had a cliffhanger. And then the next notebook was the next season. And I had, my father still kept these. There's 50 of these notebooks that were the same sort of story. And it was all stemming from one of my first television experiences, which was accidentally watching an episode of Dynasty that my mom was watching. And I sort of went into a room and laid down and watched an episode, and it happened to be the Moldavian Wedding Massacre.
Oh my God.
Episode. And at the end, when they're all laying there and it's a cliffhanger of who lives, who dies, I was hooked. And I was probably too young to see it, but it really seared itself into my psyche. So when this came around, I sort of remembered that soap style, the serial soap style, I love. Like, I just love it. So I would love to do others. There's one of my favorite mystery writers is Donna Leon, and she has these murder mysteries set in Venice, and there's a detective in each one, and I am currently listening to all the books. I think I'm in book 15 out of like 30 or something, and I thought, this should be a series. You know, like, I just lean towards it's either a series or a feature. And nowadays, I think series are, if they're well made, can be looked at as just a long movie.
Yes.
I wish they would do The Da Vinci Code and some of Dan Brown's books as a series, like adapting it directly from the book, as opposed to trying to shrink it down into 2 hours or something.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. I love serial storytelling. I would love to do another episodic something. For sure.
I would love a season 2 of Bloody Famous because you have it set up perfectly to do a season 2 with a guy. And we're not going to say who for those that haven't seen the series yet. But you leave it there with potential for a second series or a potential to take it in another direction based on how we leave Amira.
Right.
You know,
I mean, I would think it could easily be a sort of a spinoff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like the one year there's The Bachelor, and then whoever's not picked at the very end gets his own show, which is then, or she's then The Bachelorette, and then it goes back to The Bachelor, and it just goes on and on and on forever.
Or this is primed also for a Mission Impossible kind of spy thriller, too.
Totally.
You could go in that total direction as well, based on the way you and Elizabeth have this structured. I'd be happy with either one.
Me too, quite frankly.
I'd be happy with either one. So now, when are you going to have your current film finished and out of post? Are you doing the fest? Will you do the fest circuit with it, or just get it right out there in distribution? What's the plan?
Well, since it's a feature, we'll do it the way that I have done my features, which is festivals, distributor, sales agent, and then release it that way. But it should be done and ready soon enough.
I mean,
we're real close.
I mean, my whole point is you got to get on the fest circuit. You've got to get it done so that I can have you back on the show for the fifth time, which will just break Frank Myers' heart. Frank is gunning. He wants to be the first person to be on five times.
Well, then I better hurry.
You need to hurry. Yes. You know, Frank wants, and he has maintained this. He said this on air. It's like he thinks that when he hits five times, I should have, just like Saturday Night Live does for their five-time host, I should have a behind-the-lens five-time appearance shirt or silk jacket made for him. And I said, well,
oh, how funny.
You got a couple other people hot on your tail. You're right behind Frank. You and Frank are neck and neck now with four apiece.
Okay, I'll get on it.
So you got to get on this, or I'll have you both on the show at the same time.
That would be fun.
That would be hilarious. And just have you both on for the whole hour together.
Totally.
Because both of you, because Frank directs, he directs music videos, he's got a couple documentaries out, he's also a musician, has been for years, he's with Trading, who's he with? Streetwalking Cheetahs, Trading Aces, Fear, he's been touring with Fear lately, he's going back to Spain in August, on a world tour with them. So it's just, you know, you and he's written books. The two of you have so much in common with your diverse
cool.
activities. Yeah, I think that, yeah, I have to aim for that, to have both of you do a show together. Because I think everybody would really love that. And to hear you guys comparing notes on your approach to
things. Oh, completely.
Yeah. See, once in a while my brain works, Steve. Not often, but once in a while it does. So now what else have you got going besides Post? Any more books in the pipeline?
I am editing a book called Accessing Creativity. And that's really fun. I need to focus more time on it, but because we've been finishing up the Venice Love Story movie, I sort of set it aside and I've been working on the last few days, but I need to just get that finished so I can have it done and out.
Mm-hmm. Another question for you on Bloody Famous and going with the streaming process. A lot of people now, they're choosing to go direct to streaming. What was that, to streaming and probably screaming along with it? But what was that process like for you? Did you just reach out to Prime? What is that like for filmmakers out there that have something, they think it should go on streaming, and they're not going the traditional route of sales, distribution, and all of that?
Well, you do have to reach out individually and try, either have a distributor help you do it, or you do it yourself individually one by one. But it was interesting to learn about it at the same time, because there are no film festivals, you know, for series. So it's
right.
Like we couldn't do it the same way that one would approach getting a movie out there. And so that was an interesting learning curve also, with how do we just release it without, you know, any advance buzz per se, to just get it out. And when I consulted with a lot of people, and when it came time to get it out there, everybody pretty much said, you just want to get it on as many platforms as you can, mm-hmm. as opposed to trying to get an exclusive with any of the platforms, and then you don't show up on any of the others. But in this case, we just wanted the eyes. So we just opted to do no exclusives, but actually just get it out as many places as possible worldwide.
So we got Prime Video. Where else can people find it? Prime Video and Tubi.
Tubi, and I need to check. I can log into the system to see where else it is. I think it's on Plex, which I had never heard of.
I know some guys at the bar swear by Plex.
Yes, it's a very popular thing.
I had never heard of it until they were talking about it, probably 6-7 months ago. They swear by it, and they load things into their own account, and then they can make their account accessible for other people to see it. I don't know how it works. It's we all know I can be, I can, I'm creative. I can write, I can talk, I can do reviews. But don't get me into that picking platforms and all of that and how each thing works. I just want to be able to turn it on or plug it in.
Exactly. Me too. I'm right there with you. So part of it, I was like, I didn't ask too many questions because I wouldn't have figured it out anyway. And I said, yes, let's just do all of them.
Well, if you log in and find it, email it to me, because when I post the audio from today's show on my website, I'll include in the text that I always put, you know, along with it, I'll put all those platforms in there for you so that people can find them.
Okay, cool. Yes, I will.
Good. Now that you'll do. You will not forget.
That I will do.
You will do that. You can't dial on time, but that you can do.
Yes, I am so sorry. I am the only person in Los Angeles who shows up 15 minutes early to every meeting that I ever have, always. And now this is twice. I'm never late. And this is twice that I have been, and I am thoroughly embarrassed.
As you should be. But I'm going to correct you. I show up to everything 30 minutes early.
Oh, cool.
Screenings, meetings, interviews, 30 minutes, always. When I'm doing phone interviews, I will log in because I do them. I don't do Zoom. I dial in from my trusty landline phone, my hardwire, copper wire phone. And I always dial in at least 15 minutes early. Sometimes I'm on hold even longer, but always. Because you never know.
I think it's a good practice.
Yeah, and I think it's because of my dad, you know, because spending 60 years in television, in broadcast television, and starting out in days of all live, everything is live, so it's a time issue.
Yeah.
So you know you have to be on time, and then all the years I was in law, you're on deadline with the court all the time.
Yeah.
And you do not show up to court late. You will have a monetary sanction imposed upon you. So it's like ingrained in me to be early. So I'm glad that you show up early for things. Just not my show.
For everything except today and that one other time.
Except me. Except me. You're
so... But I was on time those other two times.
Yes. Yes. So twice you've been late, twice you've been on time.
The fifth time I will be on time and early.
Yeah, the fifth time. Well, you're here in LA, right?
Yes.
Yeah, well, the fifth
time. I'll come over in person.
I was just going to say, for the fifth time, when I can get you and Frank together, because Frank comes in studio. He likes coming in studio. I'll make both of you.
I do too.
I'll make both of you be here in person. Well, you remember back when I started the show over 10 years ago. A lot of the guests would come in. They would drive to Whittier and come in person. But it's such a hassle for people in scheduling to drive all the way to Whittier and then, you know, things, what they became with COVID and lockdowns and all of that.
Right.
And it's just so much easier for talent to just call in. This way I've had guests call in from Moscow, from London, from Paris. And because they can sit at home in their respective countries and dial a phone.
Exactly, which is great.
Which is great. But it's also great having people in person. Nothing like human contact. So, well, my friend, I thank you so, so much. Everybody needs to see Bloody Famous. I have watched it twice already. Binged it both times. I will awesome. I will probably watch it again just because it's so fun.
Thank you.
And you need to get to work on the feature and get that done and get the book done. So you can come back on time.
I will be as fast as possible. I will see you soon.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, my friend. And you have a great rest of your week.
Thank you. Thank you. And we'll see you soon.
Yes, sir. Thanks, Steve. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
And that was writer, director, author, man of lateness, Steve Balderson, talking about his new series, his first series, Bloody Famous, on Tubi, on Prime Video. It's a lot of fun. See it, see it, see it. It's free on Tubi. Free. We all like free. So, okay, we almost did two entire shows today, which is, and Pam's sitting in there like falling asleep or something. I'm not sure. But we won't be here next week because it seems that a lot of people are taking off all of next week and aren't available because of the 4th of July holiday next Thursday. So, my live guest next week bumped to the 15th. So, we're going to take a holiday break next week. And then we will be back on July the 8th with Brian Johnson, director Brian Johnson, and his new film, Population Purge. But we've got a couple of really great guests coming up. The end of July, I'm looking forward to it. Jay Silverman is going to be back with us again. It's been a while. He's been working on a film. So, can't wait to talk to him. But, until July 8th, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.